Good morning. It is good to see you this morning. Families who are starting to return, we are so glad that you're here. It is so good to see you. All the folks at home, we love you. We miss you. We're here for you and here with you. And we're going to continue to journey on this as things slowly change and transform. And we're going to be in this together. And you have noticed, and most of you have participated over the last year, I've felt it was very important to get as many of our members as possible to participate in one form or another during the service. That's a good thing at any time, and it's especially been good when we've been separated to see one another, to hear one another's voices, to see the ways that God is still working through the lives of folks. And so this morning, we've got two different family units reading scripture for us. And the first is going to be Sebram Bell from Luke 18. And then I reached out to the grooms this week and said, hey, would you be willing to do a video? And Kendall said, I can do one better. We're coming back this week. And I said, fantastic. Then just come to the front and share. And so I think Kendall and Owen are going to read for us after Sebram reads from Luke 18. So you guys can work your way up or you can stay there, whichever you prefer. But we're going to start in Luke 18, starting in verse 9 from Sebram, and then Kendall and Owen will jump up here and read from Luke 18, starting in verse 35.
I will be reading from Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He could not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. May God bless the reading of his word.
Good to be back. We're going to read from Luke 18, starting in verse 35, the story of the blind beggar receiving his sight. As Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He called out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. Those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me.
Jesus stopped and ordered the man to be brought to him. When he came near, Jesus asked him, What do you want me to do for you? Lord, I want to see, he replied. Jesus said to him, Receive your sight, your faith has healed to you. Immediately, he received his sight and followed Jesus, praising God. When all the people saw it, they also praised God.
Kendall, good job. Owen, great job. So glad you both participated. All right, so I want to start this morning by telling you about Leah Holland from Georgetown, Kentucky. It was just a little more than a year ago that she was spending time with a friend, and in the middle of their conversation, they started to share about qualities about the other person that they appreciated, that they found admirable, and it ended up being a really meaningful conversation. And the things that Leah's friend said about her ended up being so meaningful, so impactful, that she decided to tattoo the image of what her friend said on her arm. And I'll show that to you in just a moment. But I want to share with you the essence of what her friend said. Her friend said that, in essence, she was undeniably herself. Leah was not the kind of person to pretend. She wasn't someone who had this sort of grand facade of perfection, of having it all together, of being put together, that she was authentic, that she was a person of integrity, and who she was reflected in how she interacted with other people. And Leah really appreciated what she said, and she also thought that the way her friend said it was poetic enough that she thought, well, I want to ink this thing on my arm so I can always remember it. So this was March 4th when she got her tattoo, March 4th of 2020, just a little over a year ago. Let's go ahead and show the tattoo that she got. Her tattoo, for those of you having a hard time reading it, says, "Courageously and radically refuse to wear a mask." March 4th of 2020. That was really awkward timing, because it was right after that the pandemic kicked in and everything started to shut down and mask mandates went up all around the country, enough so that she said she went all through the next year trying to hide this tattoo, wearing long sleeves even in the summers, just so she wouldn't come across as someone who was really fighting against the system. She's like, you know, I believe it's been important to do. So it was embarrassing. It's one of those things where the timing was awful. But the metaphor is good. The sentiment is good, to be the kind of person that is authentic, that doesn't fake it all the time, that is not trying to put up a facade, but can be real, can be honest, can be authentic, the kind of person that can embrace your strengths as gifts from God, as God designed, but the kind of person that can also be honest enough with themselves and with others about their shortcomings, about their struggles, about their sins. What you see is what you get, because when you can be honest about who you are, including those struggles and sins, Jesus says that's the kind of truth that sets us free. So, in our passages that we heard this morning, we were introduced to three different people. Two of the people refused to pretend. They refused to politely put on airs. They knew their need, and they made their needs known. But the first person we encounter, the Pharisee, didn't seem to think he had any needs, at least not as far as his standing in front of God went and his standing in comparison to other people were concerned. So let me give you a little background behind this parable that would be helpful to understand. At the temple, every day, there was one service that would happen twice a day, at dawn and then 3 in the afternoon, and that was an atonement offering for the people. And it began outside the sanctuary at the great high altar with a sacrifice for the sins of Israel. And there was a private ritual with trumpets and clanging of cymbals and incense and reading of the psalm. And then eventually the priest would enter the building and worshipers could offer private prayers. But you may remember that for a long time in the ancient world, even if an individual offered private prayers, they weren't silent prayers. They were spoken prayers. So isn't this an interesting prayer on all kinds of fronts that we hear from the Pharisee. He stands back, but not in the way that the tax collector does. You get the feeling that he doesn't want to be defiled by the unclean people. And then he prays, and he prays as people did. He prays out loud, and his prayer comes across as if he's making a case for his religious righteousness. It is a spoken resume for everyone to hear of all the good moral deeds that he does. And he does do good things. But then it takes a turn. It's not just about good things that he does, which isn't the best approach to prayer anyway. But then he decides to start sniping at the people around them, just easy prey, picking them off, ending with the tax collector. Have you ever heard a prayer that doesn't exactly sound like a prayer? It sounds more like a sermon directed at other people. Like, whoa, this thing is getting pointed. I don't think he's talking to God anymore. I don't think she's talking to God anymore. They sound like they're talking about us. Now contrast that with the tax collector. And if you've been with us in this Luke study, you know how many times tax collectors keep popping up because they're not at all popular. They're not at all considered righteous people. This tax collector stands far off and he beats his chest. He is contrite in what he says and how he says it, and how he stands in relation to other people and to God. The tax collector knows he is dependent on God's mercy. So let's go back to the verse that kicks this off in the first place. To some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. Now, this term righteousness and this characteristic of righteousness is actually a very important concept in the Old Testament. You wanted to be someone who was counted among the righteous. You wanted to be a righteous individual because that means you are someone who is seeking to live in loyalty and love to God through the law. But here's what the Old Testament continues to make clear. Righteousness is bestowed by God as God's act of mercy, God's act of grace. It is initiated by God. Covenant is initiated by God. So the righteous are those who are receptive to the relationship, the covenant that God offers. Righteousness are those who are responding to the unfailing love of God and then seeking to live under the ways of God. Or to put it more simply, it's not about you. It's about God. It always has been. That's not just a New Testament idea. It has always been God who initiates. It has always been God who sustains. So back to the Pharisee and the tax collector. By the end of the parable, Jesus says there is only one person who walks away from that experience in right standing before God. And it is the person who is humble enough to know that their standing before God is God's doing, not his. And the more self-righteous we are in looking down on others, the closer we are to rejecting God's mercy. And it's not because God isn't still offering it. It's because we convince ourselves that we don't need it. Now, here's an important addendum to this. I think most of us know, if we're honest, that far too many Christians for far too long have had the reputation of thinking and even saying, well, thank God we're not like those people. And we've sometimes had a long list of those people, or we've had a very selective list of those people. Usually those people are people who struggle in ways that we don't. So it's easy to stand above and to stand apart. But the point of a story like this, as we become mercy-embracing people, is not then to turn around and say, well, thank God we are not like the Pharisee or other judgmental, legalistic know-it-alls. Because when we do that, we kick self-righteous comparison and condemnation out the front door, and we're just sneaking it in through the back. The point in the end is to stay humble no matter where we find ourselves in this story. Because ultimately we know we are standing only because God allows us to stand. Or Jesus puts it more succinctly, and we've heard him say this already in Luke. We heard him say it back in chapter 14 when people were jockeying for positions of prominence at tables. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Okay, but there's one more story in this chapter that drives home the importance of knowing and naming our need, and it's the story that the grooms read from a few verses later in chapter 18, starting in verse 35. It is the man born blind that Jesus encounters on his way to Jericho, and the man is on the side of the road, and he is begging. And for most of human history, when people had disabilities, they had no other recourse than to beg. For most of human history, there was no social safety net. There was nothing there to help protect or provide. And so if you were one of the select few with a disability, who was born into a family of means, then you could be cared for. But the large majority of people in the ancient world lived hand to mouth, day to day. And so you were left to beg. And that's where we encounter this man who was blind, on the side of the road begging. And there is a commotion and a crowd that goes by. And he wants to know what it is. And so he asks. And so in verse 37, the people tell him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. And he called out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And that plea for mercy is not necessarily the same plea for mercy that we hear from the tax collector. Mercy here is probably a simple way of saying, do you have any money? Will you give me some alms? Because almsgiving, giving money to the poor, was an important part of life for every faithful Jew. But here's where things start to get interesting. After he cries out for help, those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet. Those who led the way. We don't know who that is. It'd be interesting to see if that's the disciples who are leading the way. But they rebuke him and tell him to be quiet. Now, what is that about? And before we come back to that, I want to talk about British royals for a few minutes. Huh? Who's excited about that, right? A little British royalty talk this morning. You got up an extra hour early. You ventured back in the midst of a pandemic that's slowly waning. Get a little British royal talk this morning. I see a lot of excitements in those and those mostly dead eyes that are staring back at me right now. Okay, so a week ago from today, last Sunday night, Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, which is such a fun word to say, were in a two-hour conversation interview with Oprah Winfrey. And it was by far the most watched show of the evening, and it ended up making headlines around the world. I don't know if it had the same number of people watching it as Tiger King did during the summer, but, you know, Tiger King is a king, and they're just a duke and duchess. So either way, it was impressive. And this is the time for me to tell you, I didn't watch the interview. I've seen a clip or two, and I've read a little bit, and I'm also happy to tell you that I'm not really a royals aficionado. I don't have a horse in that race one way or another. I will tell you, several years ago, Paige and I went to England for the very first time, and we spent some time in London, and so we made an obligatory trip to Buckingham Palace just to say hello to the Queen, even though oddly she didn't come out and say hi to us. Maybe she didn't get the memo, and we stood in line and we saw the crown jewels, and they are very impressive. So I don't follow it much, and I didn't watch the interview, but I did end up reading a few parts that came out after the interview, and there were a few things that really stood out to me. And the one I want to talk to you about had to do with Meghan. While she was pregnant with their baby, and in a time during the interview where she said she felt utterly alone and trapped, and she suffered from suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideations. She thought about taking her life on multiple occasions. And I've since read reports, and I guess some people find that hard to believe, and I guess they find that hard to believe because she's a princess living a fairy tale life, living a life of luxury. How could someone like that have thoughts like that? After all, when they got married 4 to 5 years ago, their wedding was shown on TV all over the world. Some estimates are that up to 2 billion people watched their wedding or part of their wedding. And I do remember it was all over the news, and Americans were gawking at this fairy tale story of an American young woman becoming a princess, royalty. But from her telling, even princesses living in castles or estates that are hundreds of years old can struggle. And all manner of things, she says, were adding up to these thoughts of taking her life. And there was one day and then night in particular that stood out that she talked about, that Harry and Meghan were scheduled to join the royals at the Royal Box at the Royal Albert Hall. There's a lot of royalty going on in that sentence. And she had shared with Harry the struggles that she was having. And so he said, "Don't come. You don't have to come. You don't need to feel like you need to be there tonight." And her response was in essence this: "No, I absolutely have to be there tonight because I cannot be alone. I do not trust myself right now to be alone. I am not in a good place." And so after she shared that, people went back and found pictures of that night from them in the royal box, like this one you'll see here. And when you see the picture, there's one person who looks concerned, but it's not her. The smile is incredibly deceiving. We all know how to put on a brave face when the time calls for it. We all know how to fake a smile, a convincing facade. In fact, I think that's one of the most dangerous parts of some of the social media life that we can sometimes live, the Instagram and Facebook life. It's not just the stories that don't always have a lot of truth and can have a lot of mistruth, although that's a part of it. Sometimes it's the photos that have a lot of mistruth and misdirection that look really convincing. Oh my goodness, look how happy they are. Look how happy she is. Oh my goodness, they are such the perfect family, the perfect couple. Oh my goodness, look at the life they're living. That looks amazing. That looks fantastic. That looks wonderful. That is fairy tale living if I've ever seen it. But trying to convince yourself and others that you've got it all together when you are struggling, when you are sinking, when you are hurting and in need of help, in the end, it only hurts yourself. And it hurts your relationships. And so I think she did the right thing. First of all, she was honest with herself about where she was. And then she was honest with someone that she loved, that she trusted. And she was trying to seek help, she said. And that's not the easiest thing for a royal to do. And that's for a whole nother conversation at another time. But here's why I bring it up. I don't have to tell you that it has been a hard 12 months. And it feels like we're making progress, but you also start to realize that we're all at some different places in this journey. So some people feel like we're just about to get out of the woods, and some people have felt like, hey, I've been out of the woods for months now, and some are like, it's going to be a long time still until I feel safe and that we're out of the woods. And what we know is that a lot of people have struggled with mental health, especially over this last year. And a lot of people have struggled with spiritual health, especially over this last year. And a lot of marriages have taken a hit. And there has been a marked increase in domestic violence. And there has been a rise in drug use and alcohol abuse, and there's been a rise in depression and suicide and suicidal ideation, and some people's finances have gone up, and some have gone down or bottomed out. Jobs have been difficult during this time. Some people have lost jobs. Some people's jobs have shifted. School has been difficult during this time. I'm not going to lie, church has been enormously difficult at this time. It does not do any good to pretend. Whatever it is, be honest about it. Be truthful enough with yourself and others to know your need and name your need. And then share your struggles with those you trust. And don't just share your struggles with those you trust, but shout it out to the Lord. Lord, have mercy. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy. And do not be discouraged or silenced by the shushers, because there will at times be shushers, people who are uncomfortable when you're honest about your struggle, people who get a little nervous when you're honest about your sin. Please don't air your dirty laundry. Please don't air our dirty laundry. Please don't let anyone in on the struggle that we're having. We have all encountered the shushers, and maybe sometimes you've been one of the shushers, like the crowd when this man who was blind cries out. And what do? They shame the man and try to silence him. Kind of embarrassing yourself here, sir. You're embarrassing the rest of us. You're really distracting from what's important. And what does the blind man do? I love this. He does not become silent. He shouts all the more. Because when you know your need, and you're brave and courageous enough to name your need, there is no shame in acknowledging your need for help. We all need help sometimes. And if you've made it through this last year without needing any help, praise God. But don't put that on other people, because needing help is called being human. There is no shame in acknowledging our need for help. The shame is in silencing people who speak up when they need help. The difference in the end in these stories between the Pharisee and the tax collector in the first story and the blind man and the crowd in the second story is not that one needed help and the others didn't. They all needed something that Jesus offered. The difference is that only some knew and named their need. And in the end, it's only those who knew and named their need that got the help that only Jesus could offer.